This is Michael Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa podcast. In the ongoing diagnosis of Donald Trump's sociopathy, the former president veers between two polarities. On most days, he is the delusional fucking nutbag, having convinced himself that he truly won the election. But on the others, he's become a con man, peddling nonsense because he sees his followers as fools and suckers.
There are so many discrepancies, so many problems, and they've heard from so many people about the corruption and what took place.
I bring this up in light of the Washington Post reporting that, and I quote, former President Donald Trump's political PAC raised about $75 million in the first half of this year as he trumpeted the false notion that the 2020 election was stolen from him. But the group has not devoted funds to help finance the ongoing ballot review in Arizona or to push for similar endeavors in other states, according to people familiar with the finances.
A whopping $75 million. That's how much former President Trump's Political Action Committee raised in the first half of the year, partly through fundraising pitches like this one. Facebook ads that read, "We need you to join the fight to secure our elections."
While Trump has taken an intense interest in assorted post-election efforts, including the fucking ridiculous audit in Arizona, he hasn't devoted a cent that he's raised to fighting any of these endeavors.
The presidency may be over, but the grift goes on.
In the words of Jerry Maguire, "Show me the fucking money."
Show me the money!
If Trump's Save America PAC raised roughly $75 million in the first 6 months of the year, where's all the cash going? According to the Post's report, there are few limits on how it can spend its money, and it's paid for some of former president's travel, legal, and staff, along with other expenses. So basically, Trump is living off the fucking contributions. Much of the money, meanwhile, is just sitting in the bank, presumably to pay for Trump's future travel, legal costs, and staff, along with other expenses.
The grift goes on. Who is surprised that Donald Trump raised all that money and is using it himself, is using it selfishly? The most selfish person we've ever seen in our public life, and it's all about the money. And so you might feel sorry for the people who are giving all this money, thinking that it is going to fight this imaginary voter fraud, when in fact it's going to pay for Trump's staff and his travel and whatever else. They should know by now that's what was inevitably happen. And that's who he is.
If this sounds vaguely familiar, there's a good reason for that. In December, about a month after Election Day in 2020, Politico ran this memorable report, and I quote, "President Donald Trump has been on a relentless, misleading, and highly lucrative fundraising drive since losing re-election, telling supporters that they can help overturn the results if they donate, while directing the bulk of the cash to his newest political group instead of the entities fighting in court."
Donald Trump is under fire for conning over $100 million from his most loyal supporters, the New York Times busting his re-election campaign for a scheme mixing some of Trump's oldest con artist tricks with the desperation in a general election where he was clearly trailing Biden in the polls and in the money race.
So let's rewind for a moment to those wacky post-election days of Four Seasons Total Landscaping. Sydney released the Kraken Powell and stinking Rudy Giuliani getting laughed out of courtrooms across the country. It was the fucking worst political team money could buy, a collection of losers unrivaled in American politics. Nevertheless, Trump's operation pushed an avalanche of lies about the Republicans' defeat, telling unsuspecting donors that their money would go toward challenging the election results that the then president falsely claimed were illegitimate. The pitches were incredibly successful, at least insofar as they raised an enormous amount of money. I mean, over $200 million to be exact.
"So I can't help but be just slightly bewildered.
And I'll win again.
That your followers stick with you, whatever the hell you do. No matter how hard you screw them, they won't quit. Girl, your presidency's a mess, your policies are BS, but they let you get away with it. 'Cause they're suckers for you. I guess it pays to be conniving and cunning, cause they're suckers for you. Yeah, keep blowing bubbles holes and watch them come running, cause they're suckers for all of the criminal shame-worthy things that you do.
But it was merely the latest in a series of Trump grifts. The money wasn't going towards pointless recounts, silly audits, and hapless lawsuits. Rather, most of the funds went to the Save America PAC, derided by campaign finance experts as essentially a type of slush fund with few restrictions on how the money they raised can be spent. When Trump World promised donors that their money would go toward defending Republican voting totals, it was nothing but a fucking scam, which was exposed to the public. That all unfolded while Trump was still in office, but it barely measured a blip because his delusional nonsense created a daily sideshow of insanity that drowned out anything else. Only now that he's out of office, he's doing the same thing. Cheating his followers again.
If it sounds familiar, almost exhaustingly so, it's literally the playbook for the now infamous Trump University, which, remember, was a business that gave out business advice, which went out of business. Embarrassing. And like so many cons, it didn't prey on Donald Trump's critics or his detractors or the journalists he wants to give a hard time. No, it focused squarely on the people who like Trump enough to become his own financial prey.
Anybody who knows Donald Trump can clearly see what's happening here. Save America is nothing more than another grift in a long line of Trump grifts. Think about Trump University, Trump steaks, Trump mattresses.
At Trump University, we teach success. That's what it's all about. We're going to teach you better than the business schools are going to teach you. I think the biggest step towards success is going to be sign up at Trump University.
Students say Trump University didn't deliver. Today, walking away with a $25 million settlement, the university used high-pressure sales tactics and never taught real estate success.
Well, Save America is just that. It's a means for Trump to steal large sums of money from his followers. The difference now is that Trump needs this money to survive. It's literally fueling his entire operation. With his business under indictment, his lenders circling, multiple indictments, not to mention the very good possibility that Trump himself could end up in prison, there is not a lot of other revenue coming through the door. And let me tell you, lawyers, even the shitty ones working for Donald Trump, are fucking expensive. On top of that, Trump's monthly nut must be exorbitant. The man isn't flying Spirit Air with his followers. It cost a fortune to be Donald Trump, and he needs this money to keep coming through the door. The only way that's guaranteed is for him to continue to rile up his base and fucking lie about the election. The moment he stops is when the money stops.
Mentioned the big lie, good for Trump's bottom line, serious consequences for voters and for our democracy. 18 states have passed 30 laws curbing ballot access, 6 states shortening the window to apply for a mail-in ballot, 4 curbing the use of drop boxes, 2 states cutting back on early voting hours.
So, if you're wondering if he's a delusional maniac or just a con man out to make a quick buck from his followers, it's irrelevant at this point. The lie has become big business. But to answer your question, he is incredibly fucking delusional and most likely insane. He is also a con man. I think he believes what he says, but also has no problem stealing from his followers because that's what Trump does. He hates paying for anything. So why would he start now?
Business bad? Fuck you, pay me. Oh, you had a fire? Fuck you, pay me. Place got hit by lightning, huh? Fuck you, pay me.
Trump is going to need all of this money he's collected and a whole lot more if his good buddy Tom Barrack flips or testifies against Trump to reduce some of the time that he's facing. Barrack, the chairman of Trump's inaugural committee, was charged in a 7-count indictment with acting as an agent of the UAE between April of 2016 and April of 2018, using his position to influence American foreign policy on behalf of his clients.
Tom Barrack, who chaired former President Donald Trump's 2017 inaugural committee, was arrested yesterday for acting as an agent of the United Arab Emirates without registering registering as a foreign agent. He's accused of influencing the foreign policy positions of the campaign and administration between April of 2016 and April of 2018. This is according to the Justice Department.
According to the allegations in the Barack indictment, while an advisor to the Emirates was offering the Trump campaign election help, an Emirati agent was also shaping Trump's foreign policy, even inserting the country's preferred language into one of the candidate's speeches. Prosecutors say that Barack told a high-level figure they call Emirati official number two that he had staffed the Trump campaign. Now, it was Barack who recommended Paul Manafort, later to be convicted on multiple felonies, to Trump. When an Emirati official asked Barack if he had information about senior Trump appointees, Tom allegedly replied, "I do," and said they should talk by phone. He is said to have traveled to the Emirates to strategize with its leadership about what they wanted from the administration during its first 100 days, first 6 months, first year, and first term.
The 7-count grand jury indictment says Barrack used his friendship with Donald Trump to get language inserted into the then candidate's energy speech in 2016 about the importance of working with, quote, our Gulf allies on behalf of the Emiratis. It also says Barrack provided UAE government officials with, quote, sensitive non-public information about the positions of multiple senior United States government officials with respect to the Qatari blockade conducted by the UAE and other Middle Eastern countries.
This is not just what prosecutors call a paperwork violation, meaning Barack failed to disclose his position as a foreign agent or lobbyist. This guy was essentially a fucking spy for hire. Barack's firm raised $1.5 billion for essentially opening up the Trump administration to the Emirates. Barack is facing serious prison time, and the pressure on him to cooperate will be intense.
The other thing that I see is the potential for cooperation. We know that the Eastern District of New York is also investigating fraud in the Trump inaugural campaign, which Tom Barrett chaired. And so he has the opportunity here to come in and share information with prosecutors about that investigation if he wants to work off some of this time.
The question is, what will they want him for? Ivanka and Don Jr. are already under investigation for misleading prosecutors in a deposition about the inauguration's malfeasance. Barack could simply rat the kids out, which would start a chain of events that would effectively end the Trump family. So sayonara, I hope you like making fucking license plates, Don. And Eric, you may want to bulk up a bit. And Ivanka, orange is definitely not the new black, but you'll find that out for yourself soon enough. What's in his head could yield a goldmine for prosecutors. It's ironic that in the end, it won't necessarily be Trump's enemies who tear him down, but his closest friends. But as the saying goes, with friends like these, who needs enemies? And now for the main event. My next guest on Mea Culpa, Michael Bender, has literally written the book on Donald Trump's disastrous final year in office, entitled, Frankly, We Did Win the Election. The book has quickly captured the zeitgeist and been the catalyst for multiple scoops for its shocking revelations. Interweaving fly-on-the-wall accounts of White House meetings with profiles of front-row Joes who traveled across the country to attend Trump rallies, Bender covers the period from the Trump's first impeachment in December of 2019 through his second acquittal in February of 2021. Along the way, Bender sheds light on internal rivalries over the responses to the coronavirus pandemic, documents how cavalier attitudes towards health and safety measures helped spread COVID-19 in the White House, delivers pointed assessments of administration members, including Mike Pence. It was sometimes difficult to tell where his loyalty ended and his subservience began, and notes the near constant flow of leaked information to the press. Throughout, he paints a credible portrait of how a lack of coordination and Trump's own preference for chaos as an operating principle doomed the re-election bid. For the past several weeks, the drip, drip, drip of revelations from Bender's book have included reports of Trump telling John Kelly, then White House chief of staff, that Hitler did a lot of good things. Bender also writes of Trump urging the military to beat the fuck out of protesters for racial justice and to crack their skulls. I don't want to spoil any more of the book, but we're incredibly fortunate to have him on Mea Culpa. So let's listen now to that conversation. Okay, so Michael, we know that Trump sat for 22 different interviews connected to a slew of books coming out about his presidency, including your incredible book. Frankly, we did win the election. Now, knowing how he operates, he probably figured that he could somehow charm you and steer the direction of the book, because that's how he thinks. What was the case when you sat down with him at Mar-a-Lago?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael. So I sat down with him twice, once in March and once in May. And of course, that's absolutely why he had me down and everyone else's, is he wants to, at best, control the story of the book and at least get his voice, inject his voice into the narrative. And that was the case with me too. I mean, I caught him at a moment of transition. I write in the book that it was this moment between, his time as leader of the free world, what he was sort of transitioning into, which was more of the king of Mar-a-Lago, the king of Palm Beach. He was successful to a degree, 100%. I mean, the epilogue of the book is the scene at Mar-a-Lago. When I was down there, he invited me to dinner after the first interview. And it is this, it was just this amazing scene where all of his guests are seated for dinner out on the terrace, whatever that is, a few dozen tables or so. And his table's in the middle of it all, sort of separated by a velvet rope. And he comes in after everybody is seated. And as soon as he walks into under the terrace, there's a huge standing ovation, right? And some of the guests leave during dinner and stop by his table and say hello. And then when Trump gets up at the end of dinner, there's another huge resounding applause. But this time everybody's had, a drink or two into it. And it does, it starts to really take on the feel of more of his own kind of private campaign rally. Right. This is like the Palm Beach version of a mega Trump rally.
Yeah, well, they're also very thankful, which is why that they stand up and they applaud for him. They're thankful that he didn't bring Rudy so that he didn't stink up the whole fucking place with his farting, right? And the fact that Donald didn't choke over probably, I bet you he had steak when you were there with him having dinner. Am I correct?
That's a very good bet, Michael. You know him well. These people do, they're on one hand, they are dues-paying members, right? And so they're not exactly, friends in the traditional sense that you or I would think of. But I remember even from the 2016 campaign and, he'd have election nights, right, during all those primary nights at his different resorts and invite all the club members from their different resorts to the primary night. And they were all rooting for him. And I just remember that how many people would make these analogies to me of like, he's running for president and he's doing all of these things, but yet he was just here this afternoon and checking on the, on how well the greens have been manicured and wanting to know why the fairways weren't up to his standard.
Were dry, were dried out, and that they hadn't been aerated.
Yeah, exactly.
Yet.
Like on one hand,
or how come his?
He was juggling both things, but I just remember being stunned that someone running for president would bother to take the time to not outsource that. Those sorts of, decisions about, maintenance of the golf course.
I mean, I heard one guy turn around and he was with one of the golf courses. Trump came in and he was angry about why there weren't MAGA hats or MAGA T-shirts and other sort of swag, at the various different locations while the guy is sitting there and running for the presidency. I mean, you have to admit it's a very different type of presidency than any other presidency in history.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. I mean, that was why that was why he was loved, and that was why he was hated, right? I mean, both sides of the coin there, and that was so obvious from the first day. And really, one of the things I try to do in this book is, the story is 2020, and kind of the bookends of this book are starts with the first impeachment and ends with the second impeachment. But I try to inject my experiences and my in context that I was around for in 2016, and certainly the first few years of the White House into the backstory of this book.
Hey, Michael, who set up the meeting with you and Trump? Was that done through Jared? Was it done through Madeleine Westerhout? Who set up the meeting for book?
The interviews?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jason Miller was doing press for him after the campaign, post-presidency. So it's mostly through.
And that's who you set it up with?
Yeah, mostly. I mean, you know how it goes in Trump world that, like, you can never rely on one way in, right? So so for both of them, I had to make sure that multiple people, were letting him know and that I was interested and working on the book. And I mean, heck, he had known about this book for the better part of a year. I mean, the first time I brought this book up to him was when Sarah Sanders was press secretary, Michael. And then it was just like a series of requests for the better part of a year. In fact, I sat with him in June of 2020 in the Oval Office during an interview for the Wall Street Journal. And he asked me, I heard you're working on this book. And I told him what it was going to be and what I was interested in. And he turned to his press team and said, hey, set some stuff up. I'd like to talk to him, during the campaign. And of course, that just never happened. And it wasn't until the 11th hour, as I'm facing deadline, that he for the book that he brought me down and decided to talk.
Did you tell him that the name of the book would be Frankly, We Did Win the Election?
I did the second time, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why he sat down with you, because he thought that the book was going to be a pro-Trump book, Frankly, right? We Did Win the Election, something that he thought was going to be puffing for him, which is, for him, he would sit down with anybody. He'd sit down with Satan, if Satan was going to write a book about how great Donald Trump is. Michael, let me ask you this. In story after story, and we hear from time and again that staffers were horrified or in disbelief. Now, we now know the steps General Milley took to prevent what he saw as a potential coup. My question, though, is amidst all of these anecdotes, mm-hmm. nobody did anything at the time to stop the president. Why do you think they didn't get together and invoke the 25th Amendment or just simply testify in Trump's impeachment trial if they were truly that appalled and that afraid that he was going to do what is written in your book?
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to a degree why some of these folks haven't spoken out sooner. Or I do think that there are, I think it's a sort of a complicated question here. One is this is definitely what surprised me during the book. The reporting of the book, the writing of this book was how many people around Trump were not necessarily worried about the chaos, right? I mean, the sort of chaos of the Trump administration is a story we know pretty well. But what struck me was how many people thought he was dangerous. He had become dangerous for the country, they to a degree, all of them thought that they were the guardrails, right? To a degree, all of them thought that they were the ones who were the truth tellers to Trump. But when you start scratching the surface a little bit, when you start doing the reporting and talking to other people who were in the room, no one really just told Trump no, right? Which is a hard thing to do for any president. You get that close to like the most powerful political seat in the world. It's hard to tell that person no. It's hard to tell that person they're wrong. But what happened was, I'll give the example in the book of Mike Pence talking to Trump ahead of January 6th. And Pence tells Trump, I don't think I have the constitutional authority to overturn these results, but whatever your legal team comes up with, I'll take a look at. Well, what Trump hears is the second part of that and latches onto the second part of that and thinks that Pence is that he has a chance to, convince Pence otherwise. So in the book, I think there's a couple of characters who come pretty close to being, not brick walls, but more guardrails with Trump. And that's General Milley. You know, to a degree, Ronna McDaniel is one. You know, she is she doesn't hesitate, you know, on multiple occasions to tell Trump what she thinks the right thing to do is on COVID, what she thinks the right thing to do is on, you know, on the election results and some of these things. But you're right. I mean, there's no one here that is sort of jumping up and down and trying to, and you know, alert the world to what's going on inside the Oval Office.
Pluto TV is playing the biggest movies every night this summer for free. Watch hit movies like The Hunger Games, The Matrix, Pain and Gain, G.I. Joe, Retaliation, Scary Movie, Runaway Bride, and more all summer long. Check out the biggest stars like The Rock, Keanu Reeves, Jennifer Lawrence, Tom Cruise, Julia Roberts, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and more. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of free TV channels in English and Spanish featuring TV shows, news, sports, comedy, and more, all for free. Download the free Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device, including Android and Apple smartphones. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
You know, I used to do that a lot. Mm-hmm. I used to have these back and forth. I don't even want to call them conversations because with Trump, it's not a conversation. It's a one-way discussion, mm-hmm. like sitting in an auditorium and being you know, before a professor, mm-hmm. Right, at a university or something, where he would ask me my thoughts. And if my thoughts weren't exactly on line with his, we would go with the back and forth. There were some things that I just absolutely disagreed with him on. And I told him that I would not partake in it. And it had nothing to do with politics. This had to do with business. Mm-hmm. But if Donald Trump didn't like your answer, mm-hmm. five different people, I'll give you an example. I think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
There was an investigation that was being conducted against the Trump Organization. And one of the lawyers in the company went ahead and provided all the documentation that was requested of him by the, by the agency under subpoena. And so he submitted everything. Trump didn't believe that he had to.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't believe that he had to give them everything based upon the search terms. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that was really damaging, he said, why don't you fucking shred it? Why don't you just not give it to them?
Jeez.
Delete it from the computers. This is a true story. And he goes, why don't you just delete it? And the guy said to him, you can't do that. He goes, it's criminal. And he went to another lawyer at the firm and he asked, what did you? He goes, I would turn it over too. And then he came to me, fucking furious. You know, he's got that look on his face. And I use this expression, this analogy all the time, like somebody that just sucked on a lemon and someone farted in their face, you know, that pucker that he would get. And he was so angry. Mike, he was so angry. What would you do, Michael? And I said to him, I would have turned it over also, because not to, right? You lose your law license, you go to prison. I said, you know, you can't. It's obstruction of justice. You can't do that. Now, and he said, I spoke to somebody that said you didn't have to do it. Now, he didn't speak to anybody.
Yeah.
He spoke to John Barron, his alter ego, who told him he didn't have to. Or he spoke to a doorman who's afraid to tell him, you know, that no, you really do have to do that. And that's what he would base his decision on, what he thought in the first place. And then he would run with it. And he would, and he tormented this lawyer for months upon months upon months. And that's a perfect example. Ronna Romney did not, McDaniels did not ever question Donald Trump. She's fucking replaceable in a heartbeat. And she knows the second that she crosses him the wrong way, he'll just put somebody else in there because it is Donald Trump's party. It's not the GOP. It's not Ronna Romney McDaniels. She's not the one that went out and raised the money. The rest of us did. She just took the credit as being the person who was running the RNC. But she's no better than anybody else, and he knows it. And, you know, they were making more money with these small dollar donations on the regular basis, and she was just sort of the coordinator, the quarterback. She, if she told you that she turned around ever and told him no, well, she's lying. But, you know, when I think—
You knew Ronna pretty well. I mean, you were doing—you were— a pretty important fundraiser for the party there for a while, right?
Yeah, I raised, I don't know, $14, $18 million, whatever it was. It got to a point that I didn't even want the congratulations on bringing in this million or that million. It didn't matter to me. It's not like I'm taking a piece of it. This is all for whether it was for the campaign or for the inaugural fund. I was doing it because that was my job. I was the vice chair of the RNC finance division under Steve Wynn with Elliot Broidy and Lou DeJoy and so on. And we raised $140 million and so on.
Yeah.
And
what was your,
I have to be honest, when I was the vice chair,
yeah.
I was actually, I was a registered Democrat, you know, at the time. I may have been the first Democrat to be a vice chair of the RNC finance. I never had any regard for Rana. I didn't find her to be efficient. I don't find her to be smart. I find her to be just conniving.
Why? Why do you say that?
Well, she's very conniving because she talks behind everybody's back.
Mm.
And she, you know, she tried to lead people away from doing certain things. But then again, when those ended up happening anyway, because Trump wanted them to happen, she would stand up and take all the accolades for it. So she's just not I just didn't find her to be of really significant consequence as it raised. We would have raised the money if she was there or not.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I just also wanted to say, in your book, I won't criticize the book at all. I think the book is very, very well done. But criticism that I have are really the statements made by people who you interviewed. And we could just start with General Milley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I've talked about on this podcast with another guest is the fact that I believe that he had an obligation. First of all, he's a general. Second of all, he was part of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. For God's sakes, if you believe that the president of the United States of America is looking to create a coup, that he's trying to create an autocracy out of our country, and the first person that you really give all this information to is you, I have a real problem with that. I believe he has an obligation to not just represent his position in the military, but also to represent the United States of America and to uphold the Constitution.
Yeah, that detail actually was in a different book. I don't want to weigh in on that. I mean, the things that I was reporting about Milley were conversations that I was told happened between Trump and Milley that other people in the room could verify, right? I didn't know. Like Milley may well have thought that there was a coup underway. I don't know that. I didn't verify that. I did verify things that, you know, when Trump was telling Milley and others that he wanted Americans shot, right? I mean, that he wanted to shoot Americans who were peacefully protesting civil justice abuses. That was something that he said repeatedly, something he said in front of multiple people, pretty shocking, right? I mean, when it came to Milley, I reported another scene that was viewed by multiple people where he told Stephen Miller to shut the fuck up over Miller's characterization that American cities were burning. You know, Milley had the data the understanding that wasn't actually the case and that what Miller was trying to do is just goose the president. And when Milley sits there in the Oval Office and points to the portrait of Abraham Lincoln over the shoulder of Trump and says, that guy, Mr. President, had an insurrection. What we have is a protest. So those are some of the scenes that, there's nothing in this book that's single sourced. I didn't take anybody's word for what happened. Everything's double checked at least once, you know, So verified by multiple people.
No, let me be very clear, Mike. I'm not questioning your sourcing. Mm-hmm. I'm not questioning as I started my statement.
Yeah.
I will not criticize the book at all. Right. Mm-hmm. My criticism is to Milley, who I believe had an obligation if he truly believed that the president was attempting a coup or doing something which is fundamentally contrary to the Constitution of the United States, I believe that he is obligated pursuant to law in order to report it. And, you know, sitting there and saying, well, I thought I did. Listen, this guy's a general. You know, I expect a whole lot more for him. And the fact that Trump balled out Stephen Miller, I've seen him do it many times. Listen, nobody is above Trump's wrath. Not me, not Melania, not the kids, not Don, Ivanka, Eric, Jared. I mean, when he used to ball out rancid penis in the Oval Office or in his office before, you know, they moved into the White House. That's who Trump is.
Michael, even Ivanka, you've seen him go berserk on Ivanka.
Yeah, people have Mike, people have this very, very distorted perception of their relationship. That, okay, he may think she's hot and all, and that if she wasn't his daughter, he'd marry her, that sick fuck that he is. No, he turned around in front of all of us. He said, I'll fire your ass as I would fire anybody else's. That's just one, you know, of the many, many. Now, he was hardest on Don Jr., but don't think Ivanka escaped everything. It's not true. He didn't hold her in any higher esteem than anybody else, maybe more than Don and Eric, right? Because they're just fucking stupid. And she ain't so bright herself. She's just well prepared. It's a big difference. But he would fire her as fast as he would fire anybody. And, you know, look, he only cares about himself. So, you know, there's just so much that I can talk about her, meaning Ivanka, before you turn around and, you know, you just have to take, you know, a Tums or something, because the whole thing is just, you know, it's just nauseating and upsets your stomach. But I did read, Michael, in Politico that Trump knew the Hitler quote was going to be in the book and that he threatened you by saying it was defamatory. Did anything come of that threat now that it's out in print? Or is it just sort of, you know, like Rudy's fart in the wind?
No, you know, nothing has come of that since the book has come out. He has attacked the book, and he said that the quote isn't true. But Michael, you know what, the president knows everything that was in the book. I mean, I work for the Wall Street Journal. I've covered him for 4 years. You know, there's nothing in this book that was going to surprise him or any other people who are mentioned in this book as well. That's not the way I operate. And everyone gets a chance to defend themselves or give their side of the story. You know, what Trump knows though, is that, is how many people I talked to for this book. And he's very aware that people who don't normally talk to journalists talk to me for this book. And that's what he's concerned about. That's what he's been, you know, that's what he's lashing out at when he singles out this book and me in particular. Yeah.
Well, he's lashing out because it's not flattering to him, because it makes him look, you know, like what he is, which is a racist. And I'll tell you, I'm going to, the same time that we put out this this podcast, I have in his handwriting a document that he had retweeted someone who was either a murderer, racist, murderer, something like that, with positive accolades. And all of a sudden, a writer ends up writing about this story and about Trump, you know, retweeting it and so on. And in his handwriting, it says, Michael, call this guy, scare him with a lawsuit, threaten and scare him with a lawsuit with the big D on it at the bottom, right? And that's what he wants me to do, which is no different than what he was basically saying to you. The only problem is he didn't have a Michael Cohen anymore in order to sit there and to call you up and to say, I'm going to sue you for defamation, to which, you know, I would then have probably used the Tim O'Brien case, right, which he ended up losing. Yeah. But who wants to get involved in a lawsuit? That's how we used to stop some of these. But I am I'm so thankful, Michael, that you kept it in the book and that you did not allow him to bully you.
Yeah, I mean, my sourcing is rock solid on this, Michael. And I could, and I could tell that that's what you know, Trump was trying to just push me off of this more than deny it actually happened. And, you know, there multiple people are aware of this conversation. And like I said, there is, the sourcing on this is rock solid. Although I am curious, had you still been, you know, Trump's guy, and he had, what would that have sounded like if, had I gotten a call from Michael Cohen, threatening me with, you know, a lawsuit or trying to get me to get this out of the book.
So earlier on, you know, one of the things I would have said to you is that I have an unlimited expense account as it relates to litigation, especially something as significant as you, Michael, making defamatory statements about Donald Trump, quoting Adolf Hitler. Right. So I would just strongly suggest that you consider redacting that portion of the page, removing the quote. And I don't care if you want to put somebody else's quote in, but not a Hitler quote. And understanding, of course, that Hitler was possibly maybe second to Donald Trump, or Trump being second to Hitler, the most despicable human being ever created, you know, ever walking this earth. And that's what I say. You probably don't need the litigation right now. And if you with the Wall Street Journal, obviously we're going to bring the Wall Street Journal in, and you may win and you may lose, but any which way that happens, it's going to cost you millions of dollars in the defense. And if by chance that you do lose, right, it's going to wipe you out completely. So those would be the sort of angles that I would take, and you would be shocked, because most of the papers, the newspapers, they don't really do financially well. And so the last thing that they want is litigation by a madman who gave me a unlimited expense account in order to make stuff like this go away.
That's pretty good. I mean,
and that's where thank you. Yeah. Well, listen, you have to be willing to spend the money. And as I would have said to you, we spent over $1 million on the Tim O'Brien case. New York Times at that point in time spent substantially more than that. Don't forget, $1 million in-house counsel is not the same as you having to hire defense counsel at $1,000 to $1,500 an hour. You know, that $1,500 adds up real fast. The world is racing to get back to normal and start meeting up in person again. But after the year we've all had, getting back to feeling normal takes time. My journey back to the world started with being released from prison into home confinement. The only way I got through it was to prioritize my mental health and realize that it was going to take some time. If you're feeling overwhelmed by it all, you're not alone. It's important to find the support you need to face those feelings and move forward. We all talk to our friends when we're experiencing issues, but they don't always give the advice that we need. In my case, nothing they said related to what I was going through. Getting unbiased feedback and advice from a licensed professional can be refreshing and actually rewarding. When you're in a low point, you might feel alone, but over 50% of Americans struggle with their mental health. We all need help sometimes, and asking for support when you need it is actually a sign of strength. Talkspace makes it easy to match with a licensed therapist and schedule live video sessions, all from the comfort of your device. You can start messaging your therapist the same day that you sign up. Whether you're a parent, student, millennial, or just someone having a hard day, Talkspace can provide the support to help you feel better with a single message. Talkspace offers individual and couples therapy, in addition to medication prescription services. Set goals with your therapist, and they can help make sure that you're really progressing. Talkspace works around your schedule, at your convenience. Send and receive unlimited messages with your dedicated therapist in the app. Schedule live video sessions with your licensed therapists from anywhere. Whether you're experiencing depression, anxiety, or other problems, Talkspace is the number one online therapy platform to help you sort through any issue. Thousands of licensed therapists are available for you to match with. Talkspace therapists are experts in dozens of specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more, to help you start feeling better today. So start feeling better with a single message. Match with a licensed therapist when you go to TalkSpace.com and get $100 off your first month with the promo code COHEN. That's $100 off when you use promo code COHEN at TalkSpace.com. But I do want to say, Mike, that your book weaves its narrative around the so-called front row Joes. And these are the Trump diehards who traveled stupidly to every rally as well as attended the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Now, how would you describe their allegiance to the former president? And in what ways did the former president manipulate and use them for his own purpose?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about the front row Joes here, Michael. I do think that this is one of the unique things about this book. And I do think that what makes this book different from not just the other books that are coming out this year, but really any Trump book to date is, you know, we've touched on some of the behind the scenes stories in the Oval Office. I go behind the curtain quite a bit on the $2 billion campaign that was still kind of chasing its tail at the end of the race, trying to catch Biden. One of the things I'm most proud of is I'm essentially embedded for 2 years with these front row Joes, with some of Trump's most loyal rally goers. And these folks have been to 30, 40, really no joke, 50 Trump rallies. And I tried to understand what about them and what about the president kept them coming back time and time again. You know, it's interesting. These are folks who a lot of them have never been involved in politics before. Some of them voted for Obama, got kind of caught up in that, in Obama's enthusiasm and celebrity. And Obama also came from a similar point of view on foreign interventionalism, right? Like the ending the endless wars was one of Obama's items on his to-do list as well. But these are folks who, you know, retired or nearing retirement age. They don't have much family, right? They either didn't have kids or maybe estranged from their families. And what happened is they met other people like them, right? And they formed their own community and friendships and more, right? I know some who had married, met each other and married and ultimately divorced by the end of the administration. But the point being, they shared hotel rooms, right? They stopped at each other's houses on the road, and it was something bigger than Trump. In a weird way, their lives became richer and fuller because of Trump, because of this movement. But as you allude to, they're ultimately misled here, and their lives become smaller. And what do I mean? I mean, I'm talking about Randall from Minnesota, who is so sick. He's in his 60s. He's overweight. He's a smoker. He knows what the risks of COVID are, but he won't get tested because he's afraid, because he doesn't want to add to the numbers under Trump. They turn on each other over who wants to wear a mask. Libby's husband is battling cancer. She wants to wear a mask. She wants to socially distance, and she's mocked for it. For trying to take care of her family instead of what is viewed as being disloyal to Trump. And then all the way till January, all the way to the election, right? I mean, the election is called on November 7th. By Fox News and others, right? Fox called Arizona correctly on election night. And these people turn off Fox News, right? I mean, what had been the kind of background noise of their life, they turn it off. And now they're, and that's what I mean by their world's getting smaller. They're reading less news. They're only on their own Facebook pages. Their friendship groups have become smaller again because of this kind of loyalty test and these litmus tests on your allegiance to Trump. And I just think that this is one of the most salient pieces of the threads through the book, because Trump is still drawing thousands of people, right? He drew thousands to a rally in Ohio last month, thousands and more to Florida this month. It's important for, I mean, it's a pressing question for not just the Republican Party, but the country of why these people keep showing up even after what happened on January 6th, after more than 500 people have been arrested for what happened on January 6th. And yet Trump still kind of holds this really powerful piece of the party in his hand.
Well, I don't know why they show up, but those folks that you say that met during these racist rallies that got together and they get married. I certainly pray to God that they never procreate, because their spawn, you know, was obviously nothing but, you know, fucking evil. And then you talked about, you know, being behind the curtain. You know, to me, it sounds like that's the perfect reference that I talk about a lot on this podcast. Donald Trump is legitimately the Wizard of Oz. He is that little guy who's standing behind the curtain, pulling all of the levers, pretending to be this big guy, breathing fire, all-powerful, all-knowing, right? Wizard of Oz. But in fact, he's really just an ignorant, arrogant, bloviated asshole that somehow has managed to capture these 74 million Americans to vote for him. Now, while I will say that his appeal is dwindling. First of all, it's dwindling because of social media removing him from it, so he doesn't have that ongoing, continuous Twitter attack on people. But it's also because I think people are sick and tired of hearing the same shit over and over. How many times can you watch the same movie? How many times could you watch Roadhouse before you turn around and you say, you know what, I've seen Roadhouse 50 times. It's about time that, you know, that they change the movie on AMC or one of these other stations.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, that's what that, yeah, I mean, that's what got me interested in this question to begin with. I mean, it was the summer of 2019. I'd been covering Trump for, at that point, 3 or 4 years. I'd been to dozens and dozens of rallies myself, for the Wall Street Journal to cover Trump. And Trump had brought us all down to Orlando for the big kickoff for his reelection campaign. And, you know, I've been working in newspapers and journalism for 2 dozen years. I've covered politics for most of it. You know, campaign kickoffs are inflection points, right? And what that means, what it means is that the candidate is going to frame the race. They're going to, you know, give some sort of vision for what they're going to do in office. Sort of set the terms of how they're going to run. And we got, you know, it wasn't just me that, you know, hundreds of us from the media went down for this rally, and it was the same exact rally. It was the same thing that I've watched dozens and dozens of times before. And now the stage was a little bit bigger, the sound system was a little bit louder, all of the kids were there. But I was steaming. I was really like upset that I'd been duped into coming down here and you know, tricked into like covering just another rally that Trump had called it his kickoff. But then I took a breath and looked around. It's the Amway Arena, 20,000 seats. And I'll be damned, Michael, if every seat in that arena wasn't full, right? I mean, people that had sat through, stood in line for hours or camped overnight in the humidity of this Central Florida summer, broken up only by, you know, pounding rain, bouts of pounding rain, in order to go into the arena for exactly that. I mean, that's why they showed up. They wanted to see this exact show, knew this was coming, and were excited for it, right? I mean, there were the lock her up chants were loud as I'd ever heard them. The build the wall chants, you know, going on 3-4 years now, were loud as I'd ever heard them. So that was where I was like, wait a second, you know, what is going on here that people keep coming to see the same show over and over and over again? So that's where I wanted to sort of take a step back and figure out kind of who these folks were as people, you know, get a little bit underneath the politics and deep beyond the politics and find out a little bit more of these about these people as humans and, you know, Americans instead of just, Trump loyalists.
Well, in recent weeks, we've seen an attempt by Trump to move beyond whitewashing January 6th to something akin to glorifying it as a legitimate uprising in the face of a fraudulent election. Do you worry or see any signs that this latest attempt will lead to more violence as Trump's most extreme followers, the one that we're talking about at like the Amway Arena, these 20,000 plus type of people, will seem justified in their actions for causing this violence?
I mean, it's a good question. It's a fair question. I mean, we've seen this, where this leads, right? We've seen where this kind of rhetoric leads, which was on January 6th. I mean, it was only within the last couple of weeks that the sort of that unscalable fencing around the U.S. Capitol finally came down. 7 months after the riots there, I think people are, law enforcement, other Americans, people are understand what this, what this kind of rhetoric leads to now, and what some of the president's supporters are capable of, and just the lengths that some of them are willing to go, and and we'll see if that subsides or not. I mean, we just had the first conviction, right? The first sentencing for someone involved in the riots a few days ago. A federal prison sentence, right? I mean, I think 8 months in prison. I mean, that's
mm-hmm. 8 months.
That's not nothing, right? And shorter than the prosecutors were looking for. But it'll be interesting to see what kind of effect that has when more of these folks who have been charged start getting sentenced, and see if that starts to resonate at all. Not just with Americans, but Trump supporters.
Yeah, let's not forget, Mike, that we saw the same sort of rhetoric, the same sort of behavior back in 1933 as well. So people just have to keep in mind that that's exactly what Donald Trump's playbook is. It's to sort of create that same hatred by one party against another party, so that it benefits one individual, right? Our supreme leader. Now, one of my favorite anecdotes in your book that shows how clueless Jared and Ivanka, and I'm going to now refer to them as Jailvanka, right, were to politics involves the Iowa caucus in February of 2016. And you set the scene of them arriving to a hotel in Cedar Rapids and being beset by fans of Trump. Now, can you tell my listeners what happened next? Can you just lay out the story for us?
Yeah, this is the Iowa caucuses. This is, just to set the scene here a little bit. I mean, at this point, Trump had been talking about running for president for over 20 years, right? Longer than that. I mean, the first sort of teases about running for president are back in 88. I address some of this in the book. I mean, when he talks about it again in 2000 and then in 2012, I actually think, looking back on it, that he was more serious about running than people gave him credit for at the time. I mean, he was sort of dismissed as a showman and promotion, it was all a big part of his own kind of marketing and self-promotion. I think it's all of a piece for Donald Trump. I don't think it was so clearly just a self-promotion. And the things he was saying back then were so similar to what he was saying in 2020 that I actually think that he had the Reform Party, held up in 2000, I think he would have run. Anyway, that's all of a kind of prologue to get to 2016 in Iowa, right? Like, this is the first time that Trump's name is actually going to be on a presidential ballot here, and it's in the caucuses. And Jared has swooped in at this point. He comes in a little bit late into the campaign, and he and Ivanka get dispatched to one of the caucus sites in Iowa, a hotel ballroom, essentially. And they show up, and of course, like, it's Trump world, right? So nothing has been set up, nothing has been prepared. And they look around and they're horrified, right? They see all these other campaigns with tables set up, with swag, with different instructions on how to caucus and stickers and bullet points on their candidates. And they have nothing, right? They have nothing. And so they start getting people coming up and asking them how they can help and what Trump is, how to caucus for Trump. And they have no idea. Right. I mean, this is like someone described it to me as kind of like it's like a Schitt's Creek, the TV show Schitt's Creek. It's like a Schitt's Creek moment with the Kushners and the Trumps. Jared pulls out his phone and Googles literally, how do you caucus? Ivanka had recorded a how do you caucus video a couple of days earlier, but she had just read from the script, right? I mean, she hadn't kind of internalized this or certainly thought that she was going to have to explain it to other people. And so they're sort of beside themselves and really furious, not at Donald Trump, right? Not at the candidate whose responsibility this is, whose campaign this is. But they turn their fury on Corey Lewandowski and Chuck Lochner. And this is where, this is really where Jared starts, the Jared and Corey story starts. And literally the next day, Jared reaches out to one of his friends to look for someone to replace Corey with, And the name he gets back is Bill Stepien.
Yeah. Look, you know, I heard a little bit of a different story. I heard that Ivanka was auctioning off hair extensions, you know, her hair extensions. And that was a big hit amongst the Trump followers, you know, to have a piece of Ivanka's hair extensions. But listen, of course, Jared fought with Corey. Corey's a fucking asshole. Corey is completely inept. He's inept in every aspect of his life with no capability. Basically, he was nothing more than a travel agent setting up, you know, like an advance team. Mm-hmm. That's really what he was with Dave Bossi. They were an advance team. Corey didn't know anything. He didn't have any experience in anything. And he turned out to be exactly the fucking loser today that he was back then. And nothing made me happier than that day that Don, Ivanka, Eric, myself went into Trump and we got the blessing to fire him. And then we fired him in one of the worst ways. We call him in. He's sitting down, chest puffed up, thinking, you know, that he's the, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. When Don just blurts right out, listen, don't make yourself comfortable. You're fucking fired. Get out. And then we had, you know, Don Cheech, Matt Calamari, you know, escort him out. We took all his computers. I then went ahead. I went through all his emails. I found out that he was the guy leaking shit to everybody about Ivanka and Jared's marital relationship. There was allegations by Corey to some press that Jared was not straight, that he had a boyfriend on the side. I mean, you can't imagine the damage that this ass clown, you know, tried to do. And this is to the son-in-law of his boss. That's how stupid this guy is.
What was the straw there, Michael? What was the straw that, like, Trump liked Corey, right? I mean, it was like kind of, in a sense, two peas in a pod there. I mean, what was it that Trump signed off on?
No.
What was it?
That
might not be the right analogy. But what was it that, like, sort of that tipped Trump to give the green light to fire Corey back in 2016?
When basically all four of us walked in and said he's got to go, and I was able to show him the proof that it was him who's basically leaking the information about, you know, about the family, about Trump, et cetera, et cetera. But what Trump liked about Corey was that he was so dirt cheap as a campaign manager that, I mean, I think he was making something like $5,000 a week and he couldn't get anybody else. And he never thought that he was going to win or that he was going to make it to the, you know, to become the Republican nominee. So therefore, you know, he was going to keep Corey on, which was cheap, for as long as possible.
Pluto TV is playing the biggest movies every night this summer for free. Watch hit movies like The Hunger Games, The Matrix, Pain and Gain, G.I. Joe Retaliation, Scary Movie, Runaway Bride, and more all summer long. Check out the biggest stars like The Rock, Keanu Reeves, Jennifer Lawrence, Tom Cruise, Julia Roberts, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and more. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of free TV channels in English and Spanish featuring TV shows, news, sports, comedy, and more all for free. Download the free Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device, including Android and Apple smartphones. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free.
But I do want to ask you, very few people know what happened behind the scenes with the Hunter Biden laptop story and how its authors, right? Here are three clowns, Rudy Giuliani, Steve Bannon, and here's the name that you don't hear much of. I happen to know him personally, Arthur Schwartz, that they were desperate for this imprimatur of the Wall Street Journal to give their so-called October surprise credence. Can you tell my listeners how they thought that this was going to go and why the Journal ultimately rejected the story?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was approached by some folks, not Steve and not Rudy, who were concerned that the Hunter story had kind of jumped the shark and that it was getting too much attention by the conservative media, that to the point where the mainstream media wouldn't give any of it a second look, that had already become taken on this sort of imprimatur of a conspiracy theory and overwrought, and that what they wanted was someone with some credibility, some journalistic credibility, to look at their new documents and say there is something here. So I went and sat down with them, and what they had was a man that America hadn't met yet by the name of Tony Bobulinski, and all of Bobulinski's text messages and emails and documents, which was really this fascinating look under the hood of international deal making and its embryonic stage between, you know, a pair of really young, ambitious men and politically connected men in two of the, you know, in two of the world's economic superpowers, Hunter Biden being one, and some folks in China connected to, well connected folks in China on the other side. I mean, and as someone from the Wall Street Journal, I mean, it was really some hair raising stuff here on trying to get these Chinese nationals' kids into private school in New York that was hard to that was hard to get into, or you know, apartment shopping. And these meetings in these, you know, exotic locales all around the world. And again, as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, I mean, this was a great, a really interesting story that our readers would eat up. But what it wasn't was a smoking gun that Joe Biden had necessarily done anything wrong. And I told him that, you know, I told him, if you are interested in, I can go back to my editors and pitch this story about Hunter Biden and what, you know. Because Hunter Biden had been trading on the family name for decades. I mean, that's, you know, that's part of the public record. I mean, he was working in Washington for years when his dad was a senator, you know, doing lobbying type of work and PR work, you know, in politics and policy. But if you want a story on how Joe Biden's a dirty crook and how he, you know, funneled millions of dollars to his son, like, that's not what this shows. But it was interesting to me because what they told me was that no, you, if the Wall Street Journal thinks anything here is interesting, that's worth it to us, because what they had, were concerned about was that no one was paying any attention to it, right? And maybe if the Journal paid attention to a bit of it, that might, I think, in their minds, you know, give some string for others to start pulling on. But what happens is, like, you know, again, this is just like a bigger metaphor for Trump world, because the left hand's not talking to the right hand. And meanwhile, while they're trying to sort of thread the needle here, you know, go through a rigorous editing process that the Journal offers, Steve Bannon and Rudy Giuliani were dumping the quote unquote Hunter laptop on the New York Post and just, you know, having them print the whole thing. So the whole thing blows up. Trump blurts out on a call with reporters that the Wall Street Journal's working on a Hunter Biden story. And what it does is forces our hand to write the exact story that, you know, my sources didn't want, which was that there was no evidence that Joe Biden had any role in the creation of these businesses.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, because one of the more sinister figures in the Trump White House, and one that never wavered or fell from grace, which blew me away, was Stephen Miller, right? Yet in the aftermath of Trump's election loss, he seems to have evaporated, like his hair, right, on television, from public view. Do you know where he's gone and what you think he'll do next? Because in all fairness, Stephen Miller, I think, is from my hometown. He is a self-loathing Jew. He is a white supremacist, based on every single thing that he ever wrote and had Trump write or wrote on behalf of Trump. Where is he and what the heck is he going to do?
Well, he is doing he's working at a think tank here, starting up his own think tank here in Washington, you know, trying to use the legal system here to protect some of Trump's policies and you know, the administration's actions. I didn't realize that. You guys are both from the same town in California?
No, I think he's from Long Island, isn't he?
No, I thought he grew up in California, but maybe I have that wrong.
I don't know where he grew up, but okay. Wherever the hell he grew up, he's still a fucking racist. Now, I've heard from many sources that the book that Trump fears the most is from Kellyanne Conway. Mm-hmm. Now, why do you think that he would fear a book from her, one of his most steadfast supporters? And I want to just be clear. I knew Kellyanne longer than I know Trump. I was the one who brought her in when guys like Kushner didn't want her. Reince Priebus originally didn't want her. Manafort didn't want her around. Steve Bannon didn't want her around. No, none of them wanted her around. I ended up getting her brought in. Why do you think that he fears her the most?
I don't know. I haven't heard that, actually. You know, it'll. Kellyanne, I'm looking forward to her book. I mean, yeah, it could be even. She's you know, she's. I bet she's a very good writer. I mean, she's a good quote, right? I mean, she's pretty clever. She's pretty quick-witted. she was part of this movement long before Trump was, right? I mean, she was, she had her finger on the pulse of these, this sort of corner of the Republican Party for decades. This, I don't know what, which direction she's going to take this book. It seems to me that she could take it in a few different directions, but it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, let me ask you this. Now, your book also shows what an outsized role that Sean Hannity and Fox News played in the Trump presidency. Is there an example from your reporting that exemplifies how much power Hannity held in the administration?
Yeah, I mean, this is a thread throughout the book is Trump's sort of symbiotic relationship with Fox News. And he really does see them as an arm of his political operation, and is furious at several points in 2020 when he feels like he doesn't have their total loyalty to him. When it comes to Hannity, he comes up several times in the book. Early on, I do document what a role he played in some of the birtherism issues in 2012. Just in the fact that when Trump started mentioning it, I again detail in the book here how often Hannity talked about it. And it was literally night after night after night after night, asking guests about it, bringing up on his own, having his own segments on it for weeks on end until, really Trump was at the top of the polls before he bowed out and decided to do another year of another season of Apprentice. But I think the most interesting example in the book of Hannity's role is at the end of the race when, according to my sources, he actually pens. He scripts his own ad for the Trump campaign to run. Hannity's furious about the TV ads for Trump at that point, which I actually never really quite figured out why, because it didn't seem to me that the TV advertising really ever meant anything for Trump, good or bad. But he's furious that Biden is on the air all over in Florida, where he's living at the time, and pens his own ad. And it does. I mean, it's Hannity denies this. On the record that he had any role, but I have multiple sources on this. I mean, campaign documents that directly refer to the ad that Hannity wrote, and that the ad that Hannity said that this was the best one he's seen, and it is almost verbatim what he is talking about on his show at the time, and it's stunning, right? I mean, the idea of a news anchor penning a ad for a presidential candidate. And then to top it all off, the ad runs in one place. In the final 3 weeks, the ad only runs on Hannity's show. So it's a sort of like weird kind of circular loop echo chamber here, right? That I don't know who the ad was supposed to. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories of all time was when Corey Lewandowski went after Hannity during the campaign and he told Trump that Hannity's not on your side. This is how fragile of an ego Donald Trump has, right? Corey, the moron Lewandowski, tells Trump that Hannity is not on your side. He's actually a supporter of Ted Cruz, which sends Trump into an apoplectic rage. And he won't talk to him anymore. So Hannity calls me, fucking crying like a baby. Why? Michael, you got to fix this guy. So I turn around and I tell Sean to come to the office and come see me. And Hannity shows up to the office. And I walk him into Trump's office. And I said, boss, look, I fucking hate Corey, right? But it's not true. And Sean wants to explain to you exactly why he can't only talk about you. Ted Cruz was leading the Republican nomination at the time. And so he had to. But he is on your side. Mm-hmm. But he can't seem like he's only on your side. Otherwise, it makes him look disingenuous as a host of a show. Jeez. At which point in time that their relationship then came back. And then to see how ultimately it ended up, doing so well, and Sean became a big part, basically calling Trump on a daily basis, or Trump calling him, what do you think I should say? What should I do? No, Sean, I don't like that. It's not good. Sean saying, no, it is based upon my understanding. And he became a sounding board, for Trump and so on. But Mike, I have two quick questions for you that I'm hoping that you can answer. And as we know, as I told you at the beginning, the hour goes by fast. No. We have so much to cover because your book is just that that good.
Thank you.
But your book has created, you're welcome, your book has created a deluge of press surrounding a number of its more frightening anecdotes, from Trump's comments about Hitler to Secretary of State Pompeo's fear that he would start a war, to his orders to General Milley to shoot civil rights protesters and more. Now, I'm curious, of all of the stories in your book, right, and each one I find fascinating, which one did you find the most frightening when you first heard it and told, and then why?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I appreciate that, Michael. I mean, you hit on the big ones. I mean, the one that you didn't mention here is Trump's reaction when news leaks by our friend Maggie Haberman that he had spent the night in the bunker when the protests got too close to the White House. And this is really what drives a lot of the initial response to the protests, right? And he's talking about shooting the protesters when he marches out to St. John's. Meanwhile, what we didn't know was that he that this had animated Trump for days, and that the way he was speaking about the leaker and hunting down the leaker, was disloyal enough to tell this story, was that he wanted them executed, that he viewed it as treason. And, it wasn't something that he said once. And this, the amount of time this took for his chief of staff, Ben Mark Meadows, to respond to Trump's repeated inquiries about whether the leaker had been found and what was being done to find the leaker. I mean, this is what people, when they look back on this time in June, around June 1, that's what the staff around Trump, I was shocked that that's what they remember, was how furious he was about the leak of the bunker, not about the protests, not about, the violence on the streets or any of that stuff, but who had committed treason in his mind and deserved to be executed. Now, again, the people I talked to weren't sure that that was serious, but I also know that none of them asked him to find out. And that was really one of the more shocking moments that I had uncovered in the reporting for this book.
Yeah, I could see him going, crazy. Who's the leaker? I got to find this leaker. I mean, because he's so stupid. But Mike, my last question to you, and again, like I said, time just goes by so fast. And I'm actually enjoying this conversation a lot.
Thank you.
One last story for my listeners that sums up Trump's inability to grasp the enormity of the COVID crisis and his inability to focus on his job. And that's around his agonizing about what the logo for the Republican National Committee should look like, despite it being 6 months away. If you could tell my listeners, please recount what happened there and give them a backdoor view of what was really going on here in this crazy man's mind.
Yeah, this is the spring of 2020, and we are in the full scope of the pandemic is coming into view here. I mean, multiple states are in lockdowns at this point. Schools have been canceled, and Trump's in Mar-a-Lago and doing what he normally does. I think you're probably pretty well aware of this too, Michael. And in moments of stress, Trump kind of disappears into the details of something, into the minutia of kind of random random things, and in order to kind of master it and control and feel that sense of control. And what was happening here in this moment was the again, while COVID is raging all around the country, he's focused in very acutely to the logo for the Republican National Convention and showing people in Mar-a-Lago, who have come to meet with him in front of the vice president and others, shouldn't this have, not 4 stars, it should be 5 stars around the elephant, 5 stars, like a 5-star hotel, and these are the sorts of things that he's focused in on, and what was revealing to me about that anecdote again was that the people around him were stunned that this was what he was spending his time on. And and that he'd become, dangerous to the country, not just in a physical sense, but when it came to COVID, he risked his own health and was willing to put the country's health at risk in order to you know, spend time on some of, you know, on this sort of random minutia that you could be easily left to a low-level staffer.
Something I talk about a lot in my book, his narcissistic sociopathic disorder. It's just a perfect example, right? He doesn't care about anyone or anything, if it's 608,000 dead Americans or, you know, a million. It doesn't matter to him. It doesn't. Even the fact that people who were big supporters of him had passed away from this COVID, he still will continue his path because whatever he believes, he will try to make right by repeating his position over and over and over, and then using the likes of the Tucker Carlsons, the Sean Hannity, the Fox News, the OANNs, the Newsmax, in order to justify and to promote, you know, his position. But Mike, I really want to thank you for your time, for your insight. Good luck with the book. It's fabulous. I certainly recommend it to everybody listening. Hope to see you again very, very soon, my
friend.
Sounds
good. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Be well. And now for today's mea culpa. In speaking with Michael Bender, nothing in his tale of Trump's final year particularly surprised me. We already knew the man was a racist, authoritarian, possibly insane, and most definitely unfit for office. Some folks even said it before he was president. I warned that Trump would never commit to a peaceful transition of power, and lo and behold, he has continued to try and overturn the election. In the book, we hear story after story, recounting how sources were horrified, terrified, and disgusted. My question is, why now? Where were all these people who were in a position to do anything about it at the time? I know it's easy to criticize. People ask me the same thing. But I've made up for my moral failings by taking Trump to task at every opportunity. Where were the General Mark Milleys when it truly mattered to testify at Trump's impeachment so he could be barred from seeking office forever? This is a man who likened the president to Hitler. You'd think he'd want to see that man removed from the premises, if even possible. But I guess the best we can hope for are these heroic accounts of compromised people doing the best they can under terrible circumstances. What's truly upsetting to me, though, aren't the revelations that all sound vaguely plausible, as in, of course Trump was going to do that. But it's his chronicle of these front row Joes that keeps the book from being just another juicy tell-all. Here we learn the aura and power that Trump's MAGA rallies held for these devoted followers. How he made them feel special and a part of something larger. Ultimately, though, he betrayed them and sold them down the river and, frankly, killed them. One story that sticks out to me beyond the rest is that of front row Joe named Randall Thumb, who got COVID but refused to take a test or go to the hospital because he didn't want to increase the caseload under Trump's watch. These folks were sold a bill of goods, but continue to support a man who has no problem ripping them off and watching them die in record numbers from a virus that he could have slowed down and whose vaccine he politicized. You didn't win this election, and you should have been banned from running ever again. But we are, so this is best that we can do. And thanks for listening. Mea Culpa is brought to you by Audio Up, Midas Touch, and LSJ Media, and it's written and produced by Jimmy Jelinek. Executive producers are Jared Gustat, Jimmy Jelinek, myself, Michael Cohen, and Phil Alberstadt. Our editor is Lisa Orkin. It may be a new day politically, but nowadays the landscape is more confusing than ever. Donald Trump may have lost the battle for the presidency, but in many ways, Trumpism is winning the war on the state and local level. Mea Culpa is here to help guide you through the wilderness and keep you informed. And let's face it, we all want Trump, Rudy, and the rest of these seditious traitors to see justice. And folks, it's coming. So stay tuned as I guide you through the twists and turns of the criminal process that will ultimately see them behind bars. Mea Culpa, nothing but the truth.